This is tape number 5, side number 2 of The Missing Dimension in Sex.
The second year he learns a trifle less than the first, and the third year a little less than the second. Gradually his capacity for learning decreases year by year, if only slightly. This is hard to believe for the simple reason that a two-year-old adds his second-year acquisition to what he learned the first year, the third to that, and so through the years his total store of knowledge increases continually. But a person past 60 cannot learn something new in a field new and strange to him as readily as a young person of 22 or 23. Does this mean that a well-educated man of 60 knows less than a young man of 22? Of course not. Other things being equal, he knows significantly more, because he has accumulated knowledge of all those years since age 22, added to what he knew then, and he has learned much by experience. That is one reason wisdom comes with age. But a 2.5-year-old cannot delve very deeply into the study of advanced mathematics, philosophy, nuclear fission, business administration, economics, or child rearing. He would have very different ideas on the latter than he probably will have when he becomes a parent. The first 5 or 6 years of life are, so we believe from experience, most profitably spent in learning the basic things of infant and child learning: how to walk, talk, eat, run and play, knowledge about lots and lots of things. The little child learns what an automobile is, an airplane. He learns about animals, many things. He may even be taught to count, in part or all of the alphabet. However, the kind of knowledge taught in school, kindergarten excepted, seems most effectively taught beginning age 6. At that age, the child can learn to write, to read, and to spell simple words. In some countries, he begins to learn a second language at that age. For the next 10 years, he acquires gradually all the foundational elementary knowledge, and during the last 2 of the 10, perhaps a bit of preparatory knowledge for higher education. All these years, the normal individual has been learning rapidly. There is a great deal to know before maturity, and he is not mature yet. Many, in their own minds, know more than dad or mom. You see, what they do not yet know, they don't know that they don't know, but there is still much to learn. But by age 16, the average normal young person of good mind is ready to begin a little more advanced study into more solid fields, when bodies mature. But along in these early and mid-teenage years, usually 12 to 14, the physical body suddenly speeds up its growth and development. The teenager at this point sprouts up much taller within a single year, with bodily changes from child to man or woman. Suddenly the young person feels grown up, adult. He usually does not realize that at this stage the body makes a rather sudden leap toward maturity, while the mind makes no corresponding advance. The mind continues on at only the same year-to-year gradual development. The mind is still more child than adult. Its interests are still mostly having fun, games, entertainments. Sexual maturity is suddenly reached, long in advance of mental, emotional, and spiritual maturity. A human being is not a mere body. The married state needs maturity of mind, emotions, and spiritual qualities as much as physical adulthood. A boy or girl is physically able to become a father or mother years before he or she is qualified to assume the responsibilities of parenthood. But suddenly, becoming taller and physically developed, the boy or girl feels mature. A new awareness of the opposite sex is present. What the child of this age does not yet know, I repeat, he usually fails utterly to realize. The attraction of the other sex acts as a magnet. The girl dreams of her prince charming. Desire is awakened in the boy to hold an attractive girl in his arms. The girl often falls in love with love, a certain boy being the focal point of her fantasy. Of course, she only sees this particular boy as she imagines him to be, not as he really is. She is dead sure she is in love, and no one can awaken her from this entrancing dream. There are many facts of reality about this puppy love affair of which she is totally unaware. But again, what she doesn't know that her parents see so plainly, she simply doesn't know that she doesn't know. She simply has to outgrow it. The very fact that she is not mature enough to recognize her immaturity is proof that she is still immature for marriage. At this stage, the parents have a problem on their hands and need great wisdom to deal properly with it. I repeat, marriage is not for children. The preparatory years. But when does a child become an adult? When is one ready for marriage? Marriage is in itself a career. One is not ready to enter upon any profession or career until after full preparation. This preparation may be divided roughly into three stages. First, that of infancy, preparing the child for school. Second, elementary and preparatory schooling prior to, thirdly, more advanced education and specialized training for the adult life's work. There are really three stages, roughly, of mental development that parallel these stages of preparation. First, the change from babyhood to boyhood or girlhood around age 6. Then the mind, as a rule, has absorbed enough elementary and semi-mature knowledge by age 16 to begin more mature thinking and learning. Age 16 is a crucial year in mental development. Prior to age 16, the average youth has little awareness of the seriousness of life, of world conditions, of human problems, or the purposes of life. In our American public school system, he enters senior high school or the last 2 years of preparatory school at about this age. But the mind does not really become mature on the average until age 25. At age 25, a more definite adulthood of mind, attitude, interests is reached. The mind becomes more set in its ways. The years between ages 16 and 25 are the vitally important years of adult preparation for life's work. These are the crucial years of preparation. During these years, the mind is capable of acquiring faster than at any other stage of life the advanced knowledge needed before beginning one's adult career, whether it be business, profession, occupation, or marriage. Before age 16, the mind has not acquired the basic elementary knowledge needed as a foundation for entering more advanced study, and the mind has not developed in serious comprehension to the level of advanced knowledge. After age 25, the mind, which has stagnated since age 16, finds it difficult to enter upon more mature study. Before age 16, the mind simply is not mature. At age 16, it is merely prepared to begin acquiring the more mature preparation for either career, business, or marriage. It should be borne in mind, I am speaking of average ages. There are, of course, exceptions, but in my experience, about 99 in 100 follow this pattern. Another stage of maturity seems to be reached at about age 30. I have noticed that although most young people reach a certain mental maturity at age 25, a far more complete maturity of mind, personality, performance, and influence on others is reached at age 30. By age 30, the man or woman has added 5 years of practical experience in addition to further study to the preparatory knowledge and final reaching of mental maturity attained at 25. Prior to 25, the young man is often called just that, young man, by older men. I can remember how, in my carnal pre-conversion vanity, I smarted under being spoken to as young man by business executives I dealt with. This expression simply meant they did not accept me yet as a fully mature man, and I knew it. Somehow, the vanity in a young man of 18 and older makes him want to be considered mature as a completely adult, fully experienced man. He wants to be considered older than he is. But as soon as young women are past 20 to 25, female vanity usually causes them to want to be considered younger than they are. The best age for marriage. The fact that a man attains a more complete maturity of personality, leadership, and influence by age 30 seems fully recognized by the eternal God. In ancient Israel, the Levites were ordained to full priesthood at age 30, although they were put into military service at age 20. Jesus Christ, our example, did not begin his active ministry until age 30. All years prior to that were years of learning and preparation. Yet in ancient Israel, men began actual service, adult work, and even military service at age 20. This, however, does not mean that they were fully and completely educated at that age. Actually, their first years of service were those of apprenticeship, training, preparation. They probably were not accounted fully prepared for adult responsibilities until 25, though the exact facts are not given. Apparently, God has not given specific and direct instruction or command as to the proper age for marriage. God did not even count people in the census as adults until age 20. While there appears to be no punishable prohibition against marriage prior to age 20, there is every indication that on God's instruction, juveniles were considered children until 20. At 20, they were considered of age. This by no means implies they were expected to marry by age 20. Rather, that they were expected not to marry until at least 20 or more. Based on actual experience, my judgment is, and I think it is sound judgment guided and approved by God, that until out of the teens, a boy or girl is too young to marry. And it is also my judgment, and I think it is sound and approved by God, based on lifelong experience counseling on marriage problems of hundreds of people, that even 20 is too young to be the best age for marriage. Two factors are the major causes of broken marriages or of unhappy problem marriages in the hundreds of cases that have come to me for advice and counsel: sex ignorance and marriage prior to age 20. Quite often these two are merged in the same case. A great majority of all unhappy or broken marriages that have been brought to my attention were those of people who married too young. Only too well I know that teenagers who think they are in love will not listen or heed. That very fact proves they are too young for the responsibilities of marriage. Marriage is so much more than romance, necking, lovemaking, and immature emotional bliss. Thousands of young people have gone ahead heedless and been sadly disillusioned to learn that lesson too late. But in my judgment, except in rare cases or circumstances, even 20 is too early an age for marriage. I can only give my judgment, but it is based on experience. It is based on facts and knowledge. It is based on what biblical revelation God has given us. It is based on hundreds of case histories. But here it is, and young people will do well to heed it, and later be glad they did. The best age for a man to marry is around 24 to 26, after he has devoted those top aptitude years between 16 and 25 for mature education, experience, and preparation, after he has acquired the knowledge, preparation, and preliminary experience to assume adult responsibilities, after he is able to assume the responsibility of supporting a wife and family. And the best age for a girl to marry is between 23 and 25, when she has utilized those top aptitude years for preparation and is prepared to assume the duties of wifehood and motherhood, the responsibilities of planning, decorating, arranging a home, keeping it, and being a help and inspiration to her husband. I sincerely believe, in view of what God has developed, that He brought about circumstances and influences to shape my early life and also my wife's as a preparation for a very great worldwide work He willed to accomplish. I believe I was steered and guided by His unseen hand in ways I did not realize then. And Mrs. Armstrong and I were married when we were both 25. We were mature enough to assume the responsibilities. Our marriage was most happy and blessed beyond words to describe. And after all those years during which God blessed us with 4 fine children, equally fine sons and daughters-in-law, and 11 fine grandchildren, our marriage was still happy beyond words to describe. In fact, it was happier then than ever before because it had grown constantly more and more happy. What a blessing! Wouldn't you like yours to be equally so? Then heed, use wisdom. Marriage in later life. What has been written above applies to a first marriage on reaching adulthood. Marriage was ordained by God, until death do us part. My first marriage was broken only by the death of my beloved wife after 50 years. But what about a second marriage of a widower or a widow? In such a marriage, age is not an important factor. It is not so necessary to be like-aged as to be like-minded. One in God's church should never marry outside the church. There should be like-mindedness spiritually and secularly. There should be physical appeal and harmonious companionship. Chapter 14, Planned Parenthood, Contraceptives, and Sexual Dysfunctions. Is Planned Parenthood wrong? Is the use of contraceptives contrary to God's biblical teachings? The Roman Catholic Church has always responded, yes. But if the Bible, the holy word of God, the Maker's instruction book to mankind, be your true authority, it says no such thing. Sometimes the case of Onan is cited in an effort to sustain the false dogma against intelligent Planned Parenthood, but that incident upholds no such teaching. Judah, father of the Jews, had three sons. Judah's eldest son, died, leaving a childless widow. By Israelitish law, it then became the legal duty for Judah's second son, Onan, to marry the widowed Tamar for the very purpose of begetting a son to bear the deceased brother's name. The legal statute involved here is stated in Deuteronomy 25, Revised Standard Version Translation. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's unmarried brother shall go in to her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his brother who is dead. Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and 6. Now continue the story of Onan. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so when he went in to his brother's wife, he spilled the semen on the ground, lest he should give offspring to his brother. Genesis 38, verses 9 and 10, RSV. So God destroyed Onan. Why? Not for Planned Parenthood, not for intelligent spacing of the arrival of children in a happy family. Onan's purpose in preventing conception was nothing of the kind. He prevented conception because he knew that the son born would not belong to him. He did it lest he should give offspring to his brother. Onan's sin was not Planned Parenthood. There is no biblical law forbidding Planned Parenthood. His sin was his refusal to obey the law which required him to beget a son to bear his brother's name. His disobedience of that law was his sin. No such law pertains to New Testament Christians. Animals do not practice Planned Parenthood because they have no minds to do the thinking, reasoning, and planning. With animals, conception takes place as a result of instinct. It is automatic. Reproduction is the sole purpose of sex in animals. Not so with humans. Sex serves the wonderful purpose of love-giving in marriage. Humans are endowed with minds. Humans were placed on earth for the express purpose of developing godlike character, learning to make right decisions with prayerful guidance from God and His Word, and to exercise the self-direction to rightly act on those decisions. Planned Parenthood violates no law of God. Planned Parenthood is a definite contribution to this supreme purpose of character building. It entails, of course, the responsibility for right and wise planning. Any teaching or legislating which violates this divine purpose of God, which instills in wives the dread and fear of pregnancy, is a religious heresy and or a violation of the higher laws of Almighty God. No wife should ever need to suffer the fear of pregnancy. It is natural for every wife to want to become a mother. To prevent having children and producing a family would be a direct violation of God's command, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. But to plan a family in an intelligent manner, as to the time of the first arrival and the time spacing of other children, that is a different matter. Nothing in the Bible forbids this. Much in the Bible in principle supports it. At this point, I stop. I had intended in this revised edition to include a chapter dealing with the subjects of contraceptives and of sexual dysfunctions. A certain percentage of marriages are troubled with sexual dysfunctions, either on the part of the wife or of the husband. But on further thought, I have changed my mind. I deliberately avoided giving technical contraceptive information in the two previous editions of this book. It was offered free to our Plain Truth subscribers. I felt the book might fall into teenage hands, and I felt it should. But also I knew that prior to marriage, they should not be in any rightful and moral need of contraceptive knowledge. Of course, many of them have that knowledge already. Only many of them get it dirty from other kids and improper knowledge. I do not wish to encourage premarital sex by supplying such knowledge, and in this book it could serve such a purpose. Therefore, I will say simply that married people who need such information may find it available in books that may be purchased at bookstores. On contraceptives, I will mention two. One is Conception, Birth, and Contraception, a Visual Presentation by Robert J. Demarest, Department of Anatomy, College of Physicians and Surgeons, Columbia University, and John J. Sciarra, spelled S-C-I-A-R-R-A, M.D. and Ph.D., Department of Gynecology, University of Minnesota. Publishers, the Blakiston Division, McGraw-Hill Book Company. The other is The Birth Control Book by Howard I. Shapiro, M.D., published by Avon, a division of the Hearst Corporation, 959 8th Avenue, New York. As to sexual dysfunctions in the male and in the female, such as premature ejaculation or orgastic dysfunctions, The New Sex Therapy by Helen Singer Kaplan, M.D., Ph.D., Head of Sex Therapy and Education Program, Cornell University, and Payne Whitney Clinic, the New York Hospital, published by Quadrangle, the New York Times Book Company. The most generally recognized authorities on sex instruction are Masters and Johnson of St. Louis. They began their researches several years ago at Washington University in St. Louis. They are William H. Masters, M.D., and Virginia E. Johnson, who is Mrs. Masters. They now head the Reproductive Biology Research Foundation of St. Louis. They have published several books, and I think almost any bookstore would procure for you one of their latest books. Chapter 15, Engagement and Wedding Night. Once a couple is engaged to be married, then what? What should be their standard of conduct? Virtually everybody today would assume that necking is completely within the bounds of propriety after a definite engagement. But is it? Let's look rationally at facts unconsidered in the almost universal assumption. What about premarital sexual intercourse between engaged couples? Does it help prepare for adjustment in marriage, or does it prevent or make more difficult that adjustment? What are the true facts? The new morality trend has changed the thinking and the behavior of most juveniles and adults under 30, perhaps the overwhelming majority. These emancipated moderns view premarital sex as entirely acceptable between engaged couples. Such experience has come to have general public acceptance even where there is no engagement. Why premarital sex is sin? It seems so hard for humans to realize that whatever is becoming customary is not necessarily good. But there is a law. Put your hand on a red-hot stove and your hand will be painfully burned. But people can't seem to understand why they can't put their hands on red-hot stoves and not be burned. These inexorable laws are good, not bad. They are the way to well-being, happiness, enjoyable living. People can't seem to believe that. Of course, the educated and scientific world rejects all knowledge of the invisible but living laws of God. It seeks answers by purely physical, experimental, and research expedients. Research studies have attempted to arrive at the final answer to the question, does premarital experience affect later marital happiness, and if so, how? They have found that those who had indulged in sex relations prior to marriage were less well-adjusted in marriage than those who married without previous experience. But they found so many complicating factors they could arrive at no scientific conclusion. Premarital experience nearly always must be carried on under very unsatisfactory conditions as to environment, need for secrecy, psychological disturbances, fear of pregnancy, and or possibility of venereal disease, and many other impeding and unsatisfactory factors. A couple in a large university a decade ago began going steady. Since premarital sex was the accepted custom, they indulged in the usual. The girl, a brilliant all-A student, became pregnant. They decided immediately they had to marry, but they didn't tell their parents about the pregnancy. Both parents objected violently. The young man's parents were socially prominent. The girl's were not. though the girl's parents were actually of superior intellectual level. The girl had career ambitions, expecting to continue on in graduate school to work for a PhD. Of course, her career dreams were now shattered. It was only after the students confessed the pregnancy that the parents consented to the marriage. These particular parents were a bit old-fashioned. To them, the illegitimate conception was a stigma and a disgrace. The marriage was never happy. The young wife was bitterly resentful of being unable to continue her career. She resented her baby. She allowed this resentment to be transferred to her husband. Although she had consented to sexual intercourse before marriage, because it seemed to be the thing to do, she became frigid in marriage. The young husband began going elsewhere for sex. The marriage ended in divorce and unhappiness. Engagement period conduct. "We're going to be married anyway," argue many engaged people, "so what's the difference?" What's the difference? It's the difference between sin and righteousness, between ruining the marriage and saving it for a true God-plane relationship, between corroding and seriously detracting from this lifelong companionship and keeping it clean, pure, and full of joy. An engagement, as considered today, is not a marriage. It is merely the understanding or agreement between a man and woman that they intend to become married. But the engagement does not involve the marriage vow. Sexual intercourse prior to the actual marriage vow is fornication, and the law of God is inexorable. It will exact the penalty, capital punishment. It is, in the sight of God, as great a crime as murder. All government is based on law, or a foundational constitution. That underlying law is a way of life. Few know it today, but only the law of God, a spiritual law, defines the way of life, the lifestyle, if you prefer, that is good for the participants. It is the law that will finally judge you and me. That law says fornication and adultery are bad for those who do them. That law will judge you in the final judgment for eternity. To break it is harmful for you now, and in the final judgment you face the death penalty. God denies us nothing that is for our good. God loves us. Read again chapters 4 and 5. Catch anew a vision of the sacredness, the supreme God-plane blessing of the marriage and family relationship, bestowed on no other creatures or kind of life except human. It ought to be looked forward to by the bride as the very pinnacle of human experience. A bride should, and a few still do, have dreams of the coming marriage so idealistic and lofty they touch heaven. To commit fornication prior to that wedding is to profane that sacred state of marriage, to drag it through a filthy cesspool into the depths of degradation. Any man who would suggest or make advances toward such a defiling of his marriage is not fit to enter that sacred relationship. And any woman who would submit to it is not fit to be the mother of her husband's children. But what about plain necking? This, it has been made plain in the 11th chapter, is a part and the most important and necessary part of sexual intercourse. Therefore, it is fornication. What, then, are the true facts? They are far different from modern immoral customs. The engaged couple should be doubly careful to avoid any form of lovemaking by physical contact in any way. Doubly careful because of the temptation to say, "Oh, well, we're going to be married anyway," and so be unable to resist the temptation to continue on into fornication. This is not to say that a fond embrace and a kiss, if not prolonged, are wrong. But remember, the male is sexually aroused in 5 to 10 seconds or less. Any such embrace or kiss ought never be prolonged sufficiently to produce arousal and desire. This is the time to practice self-restraint. This is the time to demonstrate honor with power of will. These facts in themselves argue strongly against prolonged engagements. It is far better for young people resolutely to put thoughts of marriage out of mind until they are qualified to assume the responsibilities of marriage and parenthood. Until you reach this status, date different ones, but avoid getting serious. Fallacious ideas. There are certain fallacious ideas held more or less generally by those not properly informed. Some young men and girls believe that the relative sizes of sexual organs may become a serious problem in sexual adjustment after marriage. They wonder if they are properly mated sexually. They may be tempted to experiment to be sure, This is an utter fallacy. God Almighty placed the female hymen at the orifice of the vagina to protect young ladies until marriage. Do not assume the female hymen just happened to grow there. It was deliberately planned and designed by our Maker for a purpose, to be a warning and a protection against sexual experience until marriage. To protect girls from what society has forgotten is capital sin, indicting with capital punishment. Try to laugh this truth off because of human society's falsely accepted codes at your peril. God is not mocked. He loves us, yet if we gloss over His law of love now, we shall be judged by that law in the end. God has set a law in living motion that makes fornication a capital sin. Would an all-wise, all-loving God have made people so that they cannot be sure whether they are mated unless they commit a capital sin to find out? You may be sure that God in His wisdom made no such mistake. True, sex organs like hands, ears, feet, or other parts of the body do vary slightly in size and shape. But size has nothing to do with being properly mated. No adjustment will be necessary because of any size variations. The smallest vagina is made so that it will stretch sufficiently to allow the passage of a baby's head and shoulders when it is born. And no penis is ever that large. Also, the smallest penis will fit perfectly into the vagina of a man's wife, regardless of whom he marries. You do need to be sure you are properly mated, mentally, socially, religiously, emotionally, and that you are in love. But forget the sex until you are married. The great God has seen to it that you'll be mated in that one category in which He forbids premarital experimenting. Many a bride of pre-numerality years became nervous as the wedding approached, in real fear that she might discover that the husband's penis was so large it might cause severe pain. That is an unfounded fallacy. The only reason some wives, and they have been many, have experienced severe pain upon penetration of a husband's penis is because both have been ignorant of the need of the preparation that comes with preliminary love-making. If they will be careful to follow the instructions in chapter 11, and the husband will be careful, considerate, and gentle, there will be no cause for concern. Even then, there may occasionally be a case where entrance must be slow, careful, and gentle. But any considerate and informed husband can cooperate to avoid any difficulty. Some boys believe that continence will reduce sex vitality. That is absolutely untrue. Total refraining from sex intercourse, masturbation, or other sex outlet does no harm whatsoever, but the self-discipline of continence develops character. Many boys and young men think they can detect a homosexual by his appearance or manner. That is false. Some homosexuals are effeminate, others are not. Even the Bible recognizes the two kinds. In the 6th chapter of 1 Corinthians, quoted in an earlier chapter, speaking of those who shall not inherit the kingdom of God, we find, "Be not deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor abusers of themselves with mankind shall inherit the kingdom of God." Verses 9 and 10. The effeminate are one type of homosexual. The abusers of themselves with mankind are another type, not effeminate in manner. God, in the vernacular, has their number. Homosexuals reveal themselves only by their behavior. Some girls and some wives believe that if females do not reach orgasm, there can be no pregnancy. That is a dangerous bit of ignorance. Orgasm, as previously explained, has absolutely nothing to do with pregnancy. All that is necessary for pregnancy is the presence of male semen in the vagina, uterus, or fallopian tube. Thousands of women have become pregnant through artificial insemination when no man was near and no sexual arousal occurred. Others have become pregnant when a bit of semen was left outside the vagina but within the labia majora. A very general false conception is the idea that premarital intercourse is a good and necessary test of marital sex compatibility. Just the opposite is true. It not only is a capital sin, it will give a wrong answer. Girls by thousands today are losing emotional stability, moral security, the happy and joyful anticipation of giving themselves to their husbands as virgins on their wedding night, and also risking premarital pregnancy and venereal disease by following this modern false idea. The wedding night. Although statistics supplied by the National Research Council indicate as high as 80% of brides since 1950 enter marriage as non-virgins, and the percentage today is much higher, it is believed that a higher portion of those who shall read this book will be virgins at the time of marriage. This study conducted by this research council, however, is shocking. And though the figures are somewhat higher than those provided by similar reports, they definitely show how times have changed. The study indicates that prior to 1912, 82% of brides entered marriage as virgins. Only 18% of all women had lost their honor, as it was termed in those days. By 1922, 26% had lost their virginity. By 1931, it was 49%. The immorality curve soared upward until by 1937, 68% of brides entered marriage having lost their virginity. And by 1950, an incredible 80% of brides were no longer virgins on their wedding day, and conditions are getting worse. Nevertheless, a few, even though a minority, still become brides in full retention of their moral honor. And for them and their well-blessed bridegrooms, some important instruction must be given. What a wonderful, blessed, and thrilling event it ought to be for a young woman who has kept herself a virgin to give herself at last to the man of her dreams, the man whom she dearly loves, the man to whom God has just joined her in holy wedlock for life. Most assuredly, this is the pinnacle of human emotional experience for a right-minded young woman of high ideals. The wedding night will be a spiritual as well as a physical experience. But the crux of the physical experience is that of defloration, the removal of the hymen. By now it shall have served its purpose. There are two ways of accomplishing the defloration. One is by stretching, the other must be by rupture. In a very small percentage of women, the hymen is sufficiently flexible that it may be stretched during the first experience of intercourse without the necessity of being broken. In such cases, and they are somewhat rare, if the penis is very slowly and carefully introduced, it may be wedged in gradually. There will be a certain drawing pain, but if preceded by preparatory caressing and lovemaking until arousal is experienced and a sexual desire has been stimulated, this pain will be mixed with sensations of pleasure. It may take several minutes under careful pressure, but it may thus be possible to produce complete penetration of the penis without tearing the hymen, merely stretching it. This may need to be repeated several times in the same manner, and finally the hymen will completely relax. The defloration will have been completed in a bloodless and comparatively painless manner. But in most women, the opening through the hymen will be too small to allow this stretching process. In such cases, the penis must be thrust with sufficient power, but not necessarily rapidly, to break open the hymen. Yet the husband ought not to do the thrusting, but the wife, as we shall explain. Fallacious ideas again. Both men and women often have ridiculous and unfounded ideas about this act of defloration. Many a bridegroom has worried for fear he may be unable to accomplish it. But every normal man will have a penis of sufficient stoutness to break the hymen. Besides, he should not do it, but the bride. Some women, on the other hand, are seized with fear of being torn apart. This is due to ignorance. It seems too bad that the 80% plus of unmarried non-virgins didn't worry more about it, or the approximately 99% of males who have had premarital experience. There need be only slight pain to the bride, and that in such manner that she may control it, as well as when and how it occurs herself. Let the bride do it. On this particular night, of all times, there should be no direct contact of the sex organs until after there has been lovemaking in abundance. The preparation must be fully carried out first. The bride must be brought to arousal and desire. The vaginal area must be thoroughly lubricated. Then, when the wife is ready, let the penis be placed at the entrance to the vagina. A new bridegroom may not know where to find it. The wife should not be too timid to guide the penis to the right spot. Then, the husband should remain rigidly still. He should not attempt to plunge on through the hymen, for that might really cause pain. Instead, while he holds rigidly still, the wife should do the pushing. She will soon learn whether the penis can be slowly wedged in. Probably not. And if not, it must be powerfully thrust on through, but while the husband remains rigidly and firmly still. She knows what pain she can stand, and when she does the shoving, she knows when the pain is coming. In most cases, it will not be great, and it will be accompanied with great joy, and also with pleasurable and voluptuous sensations and delights. In very rare cases, the hymen will prove too thick and stubborn to be broken in this manner. If success is not attained the first night it is attempted, try again the next night, and if necessary, a third. If it appears that it is going to be impossible, then go to a physician, and he can open the hymen with a very simple, harmless, and probably painless surgery. But by all means, avoid the surgeon if possible. Some authorities recommend going to the surgeon for this defloration prior to marriage, but we answer, never. The wedding and the attitude. 60 years ago, many young men would discuss the idea of whether they should not wait a night or two after the wedding before approaching their bride sexually. The theory was that a bride would be so nervous after her wedding that she ought to be given a day or two of quiet and relaxation. But times have changed. The average bride today wants her husband to approach her sexually on the wedding night. But unless the bride is completely done in and upset with nervousness, the husband surely ought to take her into his arms in bed and quiet her nerves with love. It is certainly to be recommended that he do this first and delay any questions about deferring the sexual contact until love has been expressed, unless she herself asks otherwise. Every bridegroom ought to realize the bride's psychological situation on her wedding day. It is her greatest hour. In many cases, she will be leaving her parents and her home. She is embarking on a new and different life. If there is a reception following the wedding ceremony, the bridegroom, and of course also the bride, should be careful if any alcoholic beverages are served, either to abstain or to partake with extreme temperance. He must retain complete mental and physical alertness. He may be driving a car immediately afterward. He must be completely sober as he takes his bride into his arms on the wedding night. To ruin this night might be to ruin the marriage for life. Above all, he must now show consideration, tenderness, kindness, and love as never before to the girl he has married, and this must continue into the wedding night. He should realize solemnly that the purpose of this night is not to give him pleasure. Only a selfish ignoramus would consider it so. This should be her night. Many a wedding is wrecked for life on the wedding night. Many a bride has been cruelly raped by a self-centered, ignorant lout who was seeking only his own gratification. This, above all, is the night to be gentle, tender, considerate, and loving. This is perhaps the most critical night of his life and hers. The fate of the lifelong or divorce short marriage is at stake. First impressions are lasting. Make your bride's first impression of sex one of respect, admiration of her husband, and of God-ordained love and tenderness and consideration. And finally, a few very necessary cautions. The bride-to-be should, of course, be careful to set the wedding shortly after a menstrual period, being very careful in her calculation and leaving a safe margin for error or irregularity due to the nervous tension of the time.
This completes tape number 5, side number 2 of The Missing Dimension in Sex. Please continue on tape number 6.